The Green Mile, Part 3, Coffee's Hands, by Stephen King. Narrated by Frank Muller.
Chapter 1. Looking back through what I've written, I see that I called Georgia Pines, where I now live, a nursing home. The folks who run the place wouldn't be very happy with that. According to the brochures they keep in the lobby and send out to prospective clients, it's a state-of-the-art retirement complex for the elderly. It even has a resource center. The brochure says so. The folks who have to live here, the brochure doesn't call us inmates, but sometimes I do, just call it the TV room. Folks think I'm standoffy because I don't go down there to the TV room much in the day, but it's the programs I can't stand, not the folks. Oprah, Ricky Lake, Carney, Wilson, Rolanda. The world is falling down around our ears, and all these people care about is talking about fucking to women in short skirts and men with their shirts hanging open. Well, hell, judge not lest ye be judged, the Bible says, so I'll get down off my soapbox. It's just that if I wanted to spend time with trailer trash, I'd move 2 miles down to the Happy Wheels Motor Court, where the police cars always seem to be headed on Friday and Saturday nights, with their sirens screaming and their blue lights flashing. My special friend, Elaine Connolly, feels the same way. Elaine is 80, tall and slim, still erect and clear-eyed, very intelligent and refined. She walks very slowly because there's something wrong with her hips, and I know that the arthritis in her hands gives her terrible misery. But she has a beautiful long neck, a swan neck almost, and long, pretty hair that falls to her shoulders when she lets it down. Best of all, she doesn't think I'm peculiar or standoffy. We spend a lot of time together, Elaine and I. If I hadn't reached such a grotesque age, I suppose I might speak of her as my lady friend. Still, having a special friend, just that, is not so bad, and in some ways it's even better. A lot of the problems and heartaches that go with being boyfriend and girlfriend have simply burned out of us. And although I know that no one under the age of, say, 50 would believe this, sometimes the embers are better than the campfire. It's strange, but it's true. So I don't watch TV during the day. Sometimes I walk, sometimes I read. Mostly what I've been doing for the last month or so is writing this memoir among the plants in the solarium. I think there's more oxygen in that room, and it helps the old memory. It beats the hell out of Geraldo Rivera, I can tell you that. But when I can't sleep, I sometimes creep downstairs and put on the television. There's no home box office or anything at Georgia Pines. I guess that's a resource just a wee bit too expensive for our resource center. But we have the basic cable services, and that means we have the American Movie Channel. That's the one, just in case you don't have the basic cable services yourself, where most of the films are in black and white and none of the women take off their clothes. For an old fart like me, that's sort of soothing. There have been a good many nights when I've slipped right off to sleep on the ugly green sofa in front of the TV while Francis the Talking Mule once more pulls Donald O'Connor's skillet out of the fire, or John Wayne cleans up Dodge, or Jimmy Cagney calls someone a dirty rat and then pulls a gun. Some of them are movies I saw with my wife, Janice, not just my lady friend, but my best friend, and they calm me. The clothes they wear, the way they walk and talk, even the music on the soundtrack, all those things calm me. They remind me, I suppose, of when I was a man still walking on the skin of the world, instead of a moth-eaten relic moldering away in an old folks' home where many of the residents wear diapers and rubber pants. There was nothing soothing about what I saw this morning, though. Nothing at all. Elaine sometimes joins me for AMC's so-called early bird matinee, which starts at 4 a.m. She doesn't say much about it, but I know her arthritis hurts her something terrible, and that the drugs they give her don't help much anymore. When she came in this morning, gliding like a ghost in her white terry cloth robe, she found me sitting on the lumpy sofa, bent over the scrawny sticks that used to be legs, and clutching my knees to try and still the shakes that were running through me like a high wind. I felt cold all over, except for my groin, which seemed to burn with the ghost of the urinary infection which had so troubled my life in the fall of 1932. The fall of John Coffey, Percy Wetmore, and Mr. Jingles, the trained mouse. The fall of William Wharton, it had been, too.
"Paul!"
Elaine cried, and hurried over to me, hurried as fast as the rusty nails and ground glass in her hips would allow, anyway.
"Paul, what's wrong?"
"I'll be all right," I said. But the words didn't sound very convincing. They came out all uneven, through teeth that wanted to chatter. "Just give me a minute or two. I'll be right as rain." She sat next to me and put her arm around my shoulders.
"I'm sure," she said. "But what happened? For heaven's sake, Paul, you look like you saw a ghost."
"I did," I thought, and didn't realize until her eyes widened that I'd said it out loud.
"Not really,"
I said, and patted her hand, gently, so gently. "But for a minute, Elaine. God!"
"Was it from the time when you were a guard at the prison?" she asked. "The time that you've been writing about in the solarium?"
I nodded. "I worked on our version of Death Row."
"I know."
"Only we called it the Green Mile, because of the linoleum on the floor. In the fall of 32, we got this wild man, named William Wharton. Liked to think of himself as Billy the Kid, even had it tattooed on his arm. Just a kid, but dangerous. I can still remember what Curtis Anderson, he was the assistant warden back in those days, wrote about him. Crazy, wild, and proud of it. Wharton is 19 years old, and he just doesn't care," he'd underline that part. The hand which had gone around my shoulders was now rubbing my back. I was beginning to calm. In that moment, I loved Elaine Connolly, and could have kissed her all over her face as I told her so. Maybe I should have. It's terrible to be alone and frightened at any age, but I think it's worst when you're old. But I had this other thing on my mind, this load of old and still unfinished business. "Anyway," I said, "you're right. I've been scribbling about how Wharton came on the block and almost killed Dean Stanton, one of the guys I worked with back then, when he did."
"How could he do that?" Elaine asked.
"Meanness and carelessness," I said grimly. "Wharton supplied the meanness, and the guards who brought him in supplied the carelessness. The real mistake was Wharton's wrist chain. It was a little too long. When Dean unlocked the door to E Block, Wharton was behind him. There were guards on either side of him, but Anderson was right. Wild Billy just didn't care about such things. He dropped that wrist chain down over Dean's head and started choking him with it." Elaine shuddered. "Anyway, I got thinking about all that and couldn't sleep. So I came down here. I turned on AMC, thinking you might come down and we'd have us a little date." She laughed and kissed my forehead just above the eyebrow. It used to make me prickle all over when Janice did that, and it still made me prickle all over when Elaine did it early this morning. I guess some things don't ever change. And what came on was this old black-and-white gangster movie from the 40s. Kiss of Death, it's called. I could feel myself wanting to start shaking again and tried to suppress it. "Richard Widmark's in it," I said. "It was his first big part, I think. I never went to see it with Jan. We gave the cops and robbers a miss, usually. But I remember reading somewhere that Widmark gave one hell of a performance as the punk. He sure did. He's pale, doesn't seem to walk so much as go gliding around. He's always calling people squirt, talking about squealers, how much he hates the squealers. I was starting to shiver again, in spite of my best efforts. I just couldn't help it. Blonde hair, I whispered. Lank, blonde hair. I watched until the part where he pushed this old woman in a wheelchair down a flight of stairs, then I turned it off.
He reminded you of Wharton?
He was Wharton, I said. To the life.
Paul,
she began and stopped. She looked at the blank screen of the TV. The cable box on top of it was still on, the red numeral still showing 10, the number of the AMC channel. Then back at me. What? I asked. What, Elaine? Thinking she's going to tell me I ought to quit writing about it, that I ought to tear up the pages I've written so far and just quit on it. What she said was,
don't let this stop you.
I gawped at her.
Close your mouth, Paul, you'll catch a fly.
Sorry. It's just that, well,
you thought I was going to tell you just the opposite, didn't you?
Yes. She took my hands in hers, gently, so gently, her long and beautiful fingers, her bunched and ugly knuckles, and leaned forward, fixing my blue eyes with her hazel ones, the left slightly dimmed by the mist of a coalescing cataract.
I may be too old and brittle to live, she said, but I'm not too old to think. What's a few sleepless nights at our age? What's seeing a ghost on the TV, for that matter? Are you going to tell me it's the only one you've ever seen?
I thought about Warden Moores, and Harry Terwilliger, and Brutus Howell. I thought about my mother, and about Jan, my wife, who died in Alabama. I knew about ghosts, all right.
No,
I said. It wasn't the first ghost I've ever seen. But, Elaine, it was a shock. Because it was him. She kissed me again, then stood up, wincing as she did so, and pressing the heels of her hands to the tops of her hips, as if she were afraid they might actually explode out through her skin if she wasn't very careful.
I think I've changed my mind about the television, she said. I've got an extra pill that I've been keeping for a rainy day, or night. I think I'll take it and go back to bed. Maybe you should do the same.
Yes, I said, I suppose I should. For one wild moment, I thought of suggesting that we go back to bed together, and then I saw the dull pain in her eyes and thought better of it. Because she might have said yes, and she would only have said that for me. Not so good. We left the TV room, I won't dignify it with that other name, not even to be ironic, side by side, me matching my steps to hers, which were slow and painfully careful. The building was quiet, except for someone moaning in the grip of a bad dream behind some closed door.
"Will you be able to sleep, do you think?" she asked.
"Yes, I think so," I said. But of course I wasn't able to. I lay in my bed until sunup, thinking about Kiss of Death. I'd see Richard Widmark, giggling madly, tying the old lady into her wheelchair, and then pushing her down the stairs. "This is what we do to squealers," he told her, and then his face would merge into the face of William Wharton, as he'd looked on the day when he came to E Block and the Green Mile, Wharton giggling like Widmark, Wharton screaming, "Ain't this a party now? Is it or what?" I didn't bother with breakfast. Not after that. I just came down here to the solarium and began to write. Ghosts? Sure. I know all about ghosts. Chapter 2.
Hoo-ee, boys! Wharton laughed. Ain't this a party now? Is it or what?
Still screaming and laughing, Wharton went back to choking Dean with his chain. Why not? Wharton knew what Dean and Harry and my friend Brutus Howell knew. They could only fry a man once.
Hit him!
Harry Terwilliger screamed. He had grappled with Wharton, tried to stop things before they got fairly started, but Wharton had thrown him off, and now Harry was trying to find his feet.
Percy, hit him!
But Percy only stood there, hickory baton in hand, eyes as wide as soup plates. He loved that damned baton of his, and you would have said this was the chance to use it he'd been pining for ever since he came to Cold Mountain Penitentiary, but now that it had come, he was too scared to use the opportunity. This wasn't some terrified little Frenchman like Delacroix, or a black giant who hardly seemed to know he was in his own body like John Coffey. This was a whirling devil. I came out of Wharton's cell, dropping my clipboard and pulling my .38. For the second time that day, I had forgotten the infection that was heating up my middle. I didn't doubt the story the others told of Wharton's blank face and dull eyes when they recounted it later, but that wasn't the Wharton I saw. What I saw was the face of an animal. Not an intelligent animal, but one filled with cunning and meanness and joy. Yes, he was doing what he had been made to do. The place and the circumstances didn't matter. The other thing I saw was Dean Stanton's red, swelling face. He was dying in front of my eyes. Wharton saw the gun in my hand and turned Dean toward it, so that I'd almost certainly have to hit one to hit the other. From over Dean's shoulder, one blazing blue eye dared me to shoot. Wharton's other eye was hidden by Dean's hair. Behind them, I saw Percy, standing irresolute, with his baton half raised. And then, filling the open doorway to the prison yard, a miracle in the flesh, Brutus Howell. They had finished moving the last of the infirmary equipment, and he had come over to see who wanted coffee. He acted without a moment's hesitation, shoved Percy aside and into the wall with tooth-rattling force, pulled his own baton out of its loop, and brought it crashing down on the back of Wharton's head with all the force in his massive right arm. There was a dull whock sound, an almost hollow sound, as if there were no brain at all under Wharton's skull, and the chain finally loosened around Dean's neck. Wharton went down like a sack of meal, and Dean crawled away, hacking harshly and holding one hand to his throat, his eyes bulging. I knelt by him, and he shook his head violently.
"Okay," he rasped. "Take care of him," he motioned at Wharton. "Lock! Cell!"
I didn't think he'd need a cell, as hard as Brutal had hit him. I thought he'd need a coffin. No such luck, though. Wharton was conked out, but a long way from dead. He lay sprawled on his side, one arm thrown out so that the tips of his fingers touched the linoleum of the Green Mile, his eyes shut, his breathing slow but regular. There was even a peaceful little smile on his face, as if he'd gone to sleep listening to his favorite lullaby. A tiny red rill of blood was seeping out of his hair and staining the collar of his new prison shirt. That was all. "Percy," I said, "help me." Percy didn't move, only stood against the wall, staring with wide, stunned eyes. I don't think he knew exactly where he was.
"Percy, goddammit, grab hold of him!"
He got moving then, and Harry helped him. Together, the three of us hauled the unconscious Mr. Wharton into his cell, while Brutal helped Dean to his feet and held him as gently as any mother, while Dean bent over and hacked air back into his lungs. Our new problem child didn't wake up for almost 3 hours. But when he did, he showed absolutely no ill effects from Brutal's savage hit. He came to the way he moved, fast. At one moment he was lying on his bunk, dead to the world. At the next he was standing at the bars, he was silent as a cat, and staring out at me as I sat at the duty desk writing a report on the incident. When I finally sensed someone looking at me and glanced up, there he was, his grin displaying a set of blackening, dying teeth with several gaps among them already. It gave me a jump to see him there like that. I tried not to show it, but I think he knew.
"Hey, Flunky," he said.
Next time it'll be you, and I won't miss.
Hello, Wharton, I said as evenly as I could. Under the circumstances, I guess I can skip the speech in the welcome wagon, don't you think? His grin faltered just a little. It wasn't the sort of response he had expected, and probably wasn't the one I would have given under other circumstances. But something had happened while Wharton was unconscious. It is, I suppose, one of the major things I have trudged through all these pages to tell you about. Now let's just see if you believe it. Chapter 3. Except for shouting once at Delacroix, Percy kept his mouth shut once the excitement was over. This was probably the result of shock rather than any effort at tact. Percy Wetmore knew as much about tact as I do about the native tribes of darkest Africa, in my opinion. But it was a damned good thing just the same. If he'd started in whining about how Brutal had pushed him into the wall, or wondering why no one had told him that nasty men like Wild Billy Wharton sometimes turned up on E-Block, I think we would have killed him. Then we could have toured the Green Mile in a whole new way. That's sort of a funny idea when you consider it. I missed my chance to make like James Cagney in White Heat. Anyway, when we were sure that Dean was going to keep breathing and that he wasn't going to pass out on the spot, Harry and Brutal escorted him over to the infirmary. Delacroix, who had been absolutely silent during the scuffle — he had been in prison lots of times, that one, and knew when it was prudent to keep his yap shut and when it was relatively safe to open it again — began bawling loudly down the corridor as Harry and Brutal helped Dean out. Delacroix wanted to know what had happened. You would have thought his constitutional rights had been violated.
"Shut up, you little queer!"
Percy yelled back, so furious that the veins stood out on the sides of his neck. I put a hand on his arm and felt it quivering beneath his shirt. Some of this was residual fright, of course. Every now and then I had to remind myself that part of Percy's problem was that he was only 21, not much older than Wharton, but I think most of it was rage. He hated Delacroix. I don't know just why, but he did. "Go see if Warden Moores is still here," I told Percy. "If he is, give him a complete verbal report on what happened. Tell him he'll have my written report on his desk tomorrow if I can manage it." Percy swelled visibly at this responsibility. For a horrible moment or two, I actually thought he might salute.
"Yes, sir, I will."
"Begin by telling him that the situation in E-Block is normal. It's not a story, and the warden won't appreciate you dragging it out to heighten the suspense."
"I won't."
"Okay. Off you go." He started for the door, then turned back. The one thing you could count on with him was contrariness. I desperately wanted him gone. My groin was on fire, and now he didn't seem to want to go.
"Are you all right, Pa?" he asked. "Running a fever, maybe got a touch of the grip? 'Cause there's sweat all over your face."
"I might have a touch of something, but mostly I'm fine," I said. "Go on, Percy, tell the warden." He nodded and left. Thank Christ for small favors. As soon as the door was closed, I lunged into my office. Leaving the duty desk unmanned was against regulations, but I was beyond caring about that. It was bad, like it had been that morning. I managed to get into the little toilet cubicle behind the desk and to get my business out of my pants before the urine started to gush, but it was a near thing. I had to put a hand over my mouth to stifle a scream as I began to flow, and grabbed blindly for the lip of the washstand with the other. It wasn't like my house, where I could fall to my knees and piss a puddle beside the woodpile. If I went to my knees here, the urine would go all over the floor. I managed to keep my feet and not to scream, but it was a close thing on both counts. It felt like my urine had been filled with tiny slivers of broken glass. The smell coming up from the toilet bowl was swampy and unpleasant, and I could see white stuff, pus, I guess, floating on the surface of the water. I took the towel off the rack and wiped my face with it. I was sweating all right. It was pouring off me. I looked into the metal mirror and saw the flushed face of a man running a high fever looking back at me. 103? 104? Better not to know, maybe. I put the towel back on its bar, flushed the toilet, and walked slowly back across my office to the cell block door. I was afraid Bill Dodge or someone else might have come in and seen three prisoners with no attendants, but the place was empty. Wharton still lay unconscious on his bunk, Delacroix had fallen silent, and John Coffey had never made a single noise at all, I suddenly realized, not a peep, which was worrisome. I went down the mile and glanced into Coffey's cell, half expecting to discover he'd committed suicide in one of the two common death row ways, either hanging himself with his pants or gnawing into his wrists. No such thing, it turned out. Coffey merely sat on the end of his bunk with his hands in his lap, the largest man I'd ever seen in my life, looking at me with his strange, wet eyes. "Cap'n," he said. "What's up, big boy?" "I need to see you." "Ain't you looking right at me, John Coffey?" He said nothing to this, only went on studying me with his strange, leaky gaze. I sighed. "In a second, big boy." I looked over at Delacroix, who was standing at the bars of his cell. Mr. Jingles, his pet mouse, Delacroix would tell you he'd trained Mr. Jingles to do tricks, but us folks who worked on the Green Mile were pretty much unanimous in the opinion that Mr. Jingles had trained himself, was jumping restlessly back and forth from one of Del's outstretched hands to the other, like an acrobat doing leaps from platforms high above the center ring. His eyes were huge, his ears laid back against his sleek gray skull. I hadn't any doubt that the mouse was reacting to Delacroix's nerves. As I watched, he ran down Delacroix's pants leg and across the cell to where the brightly colored spool lay against one wall. He pushed the spool back to Delacroix's foot, and then looked up at him eagerly. But the little Cajun took no notice of his friend, at least for the time being.
"What happened, boss?"
Delacroix asked.
"Who been hurt?"
"Everything's Jake," I said. "Our new boy came in like a lion, but now he's passed out like a lamb. All's well that ends well."
"It ain't over yet,"
Delacroix said, looking up the mile toward the cell where Wharton was jugged.
"L'homme mauvais, c'est vrai?"
"Well," I said, "don't let it get you down, Del. Nobody's going to make you play skip rope with him out in the yard." There was a creaking sound from behind me as Coffey got off his bunk.
"Boss Edgecombe," he said again. This time he sounded urgent. "I need to talk to you."
I turned to him, thinking, all right, no problem. Talking was my business. All the time trying not to shiver because the fever had turned cold, as they sometimes will. Except for my groin, which still felt as if it had been slit open, filled with hot coals, and then sewed back up again. "So talk, John Coffey," I said, trying to keep my voice light and calm. For the first time since he'd come on to E-Block, Coffey looked as though he was really here, really among us. The almost ceaseless trickle of tears from the corners of his eyes had ceased, at least for the time being, and I knew he was seeing what he was looking at, Mr. Paul Edgecombe, E-Block's bull goose screw, and not some place he wished he could go back to and take back the terrible thing he'd done.
"No," he said, "you got to come in here."
"Now, you know I can't do that," I said, still trying for the light tone, "at least not right this minute. I'm on my own here for the time being, and you outweigh me by just about a ton and a half. We've had us one hoorah this afternoon, and that's enough. So we'll just have a chat through the bars, if it's all the same to you, and
please."
He was holding the bars so tightly that his knuckles were pale and his fingernails were white. His face was long with distress, those strange eyes sharp with some need I could not understand. I remember thinking that maybe I could have understood it if I hadn't been so sick, and knowing that would have given me a way of helping him through the rest of it. When you know what a man needs, you know the man more often than not.
"Please, Boss Edgecombe, you have to come in."
That's the nuttiest thing I ever heard, I thought. And then realized something even nuttier. I was going to do it.
I had my keys off my belt, and I was hunting through them for the one that opened John Coffey's cell. He could have picked me up and broken me over his knee like kindling on a day when I was well and feeling fine, and this wasn't that day. All the same, I was going to do it. On my own, and less than half an hour after a graphic demonstration of where stupidity and laxness could get you when you were dealing with condemned murderers, I was going to open this black giant's cell, go in and sit with him. If I was discovered, I might well lose my job, even if he didn't do anything crazy, but I was going to do it just the same. "Stop," I said to myself. "You just stop now, Paul." But I didn't. I used one key on the top lock, another on the bottom lock, and then I slid the door back on its track.
"You know, boss, that maybe not such a good idea,"
Delacroix said, in a voice so nervous and prissy it would probably have made me laugh under other circumstances.
"You mind your business and I'll mind mine," I said without looking around.
My eyes were fixed on John Coffey's, and fixed so hard they might have been nailed there. It was like being hypnotized. My voice sounded to my own ears like something which had come echoing down a long valley. Hell, maybe I was hypnotized. "You just lie down and take you a rest."
"Christ, this place is crazy,"
Delacroix said in a trembling voice.
"Mr. Jingles, I just about wish they'd fry me and be done with it."
I went into Coffey's cell. He stepped away as I stepped forward. When he was backed up against his bunk, it hit him in the calves, that's how tall he was, he sat down on it. He patted the mattress beside him, his eyes never once leaving mine. I sat down there next to him, and he put his arm around my shoulders, as if we were at the movies and I was his girl. "What do you want, John Coffey?" I asked, still looking into his eyes, those sad, serene eyes.
"Just to help," he said.
He sighed, like a man will when he's faced with a job he doesn't much want to do. And then he put his hand down in my crotch, on that shelf of bone a foot or so below the navel.
"Hey!" I cried. "Get your goddamn hand!"
A jolt slammed through me then, a big, painless whack of something. It made me jerk on the cot and bow my back, made me think of old Toot shouting that he was frying, he was a done tom turkey. There was no heat, no feeling of electricity. But for a moment the color seemed to jump out of everything, as if the world had been somehow squeezed and made to sweat. I could see every pore on John Coffey's face. I could see every bloodshot snap in his haunted eyes. I could see a tiny healing scrape on his chin. I was aware that my fingers were hooked down into claws on thin air, and that my feet were drumming on the floor of Coffey's cell. Then it was over. So was my urinary infection. Both the heat and the miserable throbbing pain were gone from my crotch, and the fever was likewise gone from my head. I could still feel the sweat it had drawn out of my skin, and I could smell it. But it was gone, all right.
"What's going on?"
Delacroix called shrilly. His voice still came from far away, but when John Coffey bent forward, breaking eye contact with me, the little Cajun's voice suddenly came clear. It was as if someone had pulled wads of cotton or a pair of shooter's plugs out of my ears.
"What's he doing to you?"
I didn't answer. Coffey was bent forward over his own lap with his face working and his throat bulging. His eyes were bulging, too. He looked like a man with a chicken bone caught in his throat.
"John," I said.
I clapped him on the back. It was all I could think of to do.
"John, what's wrong?"
He hitched under my hand, then made an unpleasant, gagging, retching sound. His mouth opened, the way horses sometimes open their mouths to allow the bit, reluctantly, with the lips peeling back from the teeth in a kind of desperate sneer. Then his teeth parted too, and he exhaled a cloud of tiny black insects that looked like gnats or no-see-ums,
At least that was what I thought then. They swirled furiously between his knees, turned white, and disappeared. Suddenly all the strength went out of my midsection. It was as if the muscles there had turned to water. I slumped back against the stone side of Coffee's cell. I remember thinking the name of the Savior, Christ, 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 over and over like that. And I remember thinking that the fever had driven me delirious. That was all. Then I became aware that Delacroix was bawling for help. He was telling the world that John Coffee was killing me and telling it at the top of his lungs. Coffee was bending over me, all right, but only to make sure I was okay. "Shut up, Del," I said, and stood up. I waited for the pain to rip into my guts, but it didn't happen. I was better. Really. There was a moment of dizziness, but that passed even before I was able to reach out and grab the bars of Coffee's cell door for balance. "I'm totally okey-doke."
"You get on out of there,"
Delacroix said, sounding like a nervy old woman telling a kid to climb down out of that air apple tree.
"You ain't supposed to be in there with no one else on the block."
I looked at John Coffee, who sat on the bunk with his huge hands on the tree stumps of his knees. John Coffee looked back at me. He had to tilt his head up a little, but not much. "What did you do, big boy?" I asked in a low voice. "What did you do to me?"
"Helped," he said. "I helped it, didn't I?"
"Yeah, I guess, but how? How did you help it?" He shook his head, right, left, back to dead center. He didn't know how he'd helped it, how he'd cured it, and his placid face suggested that he didn't give a rat's ass. Any more than I'd give a rat's ass about the mechanics of running when I was leading in the last 50 yards of a 4th of July 2-miler. I thought about asking him how he'd known I was sick in the first place, except that would undoubtedly have gotten the same headshake. There's a phrase I read somewhere and never forgot, something about an enigma wrapped in a mystery. That's what John Coffee was. And I suppose the only reason he could sleep at night was because he didn't care. Percy called him the idiot, which was cruel but not too far off the mark. Our big boy knew his name and knew it wasn't spelled like the drink, and that was just about all he cared to know. As if to emphasize this for me, he shook his head in that deliberate way one more time, then lay down on his bunk with his hands clasped under his left cheek like a pillow and his face to the wall. His legs dangled off the end of the bunk from the shins on down, but that never seemed to bother him. The back of his shirt had pulled up, and I could see the scars that crisscrossed his skin.